This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For the past 15 years or so, Robert Frank has posed a challenge to his first-year economics students. Come up with a question. Why, for example, why do taxi drivers quit early on rainy days? And then apply the principles of economics to find an answer. It's an exercise in logic and the study of human behavior that he argues teaches a great deal more than the usual Econ 101 diet of graphs and algebra. It's an approach he borrowed from biology, where scientists raised interesting questions about the world around them, and so he calls his new book The Economic Naturalist, and it's mostly made up of those questions and answers. Why do 24-hour convenience stores have locks on their doors? Why is there a light in your refrigerator but not in your freezer? We want you to take Professor Frank's challenge today. Come up with a question based on something you've observed. Why do men and women's shirts button on the opposite side? And propose an answer. We want your observations and your theories. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, the differences between summer jobs and summer internships, and we remember the scooter, Phil Rizzuto, who died earlier today. But first, the economic naturalist, Robert Frank, joins us from a studio in Ithaca, New York, where he's a professor of management and economics at Cornell. He's here to lend us an invisible hand. Professor Frank, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
And so why do taxi drivers quit early on rainy days? Those should be their most profitable days.
Yeah, that's actually an example drawn from some work by my former colleague, Dick Thaler. It's really at the intersection of psychology and economics because the taxi drivers don't seem to be doing what would be in their best economic interest. On a rainy day, the demand for cabs is way higher than it is on a sunny day. People like to walk when it's nice out the fares that they get on rainy days are so lucrative per hour that they can reach their daily target income, which is what they carry around in their minds. I'll work until I earn so many dollars much sooner than on a sunny day, so they quit early. If they would have a target monthly income, then the economic logic of decision-making would dictate exactly the reverse. They should work longer on rainy days and take off early on sunny days when there aren't that many fares to have.
And which economic principle does that question and answer illustrate?
Well, there's the granddaddy of all economic principles, the cost-benefit principle. It says do it if the benefits exceed the costs. That's both a prescriptive principle. It tells you what you ought to do. It's also a descriptive principle in the sense that people often really do follow the cost-benefit principle. Here's a case where they don't seem to be following it in any literal sense. They're ignoring some really good opportunities, just at least on the surface it looks that way.
Mm-hmm. So help our listeners out who may be trying to answer your challenge. How do you pose it to your students? Because coming up with these questions isn't so easy.
They have to do two of them during the semester, Neil, and I do stress to them that the question should be interesting. I tell them, look, you only have one chance to engage people's attention in the world usually, and if you start off with something really boring, why are they going to want to listen to you? So
lesson many economists don't seem to have absorbed, I must say.
It takes a while to come up with an interesting question. That's good because then you have to think of more things on the way there. If you do come up with an interesting one, that's good too because you'll really want to know the answer to it. But I think mainly I want them to come up with an interesting one so they'll want to talk about it with other people. It seems that it's that active step that really cements the knowledge in their brains. Mm-hmm. You can read about something, you can hear somebody talk about something all you want, but if you don't really use it actively yourself, it doesn't really get cemented into your brain.
A story is the way that the human brain seems to process information most easily, certainly more easily than in a pie chart.
We evolved as storytellers. There's no doubt about it. The narrative learning theorists today, psychologists, tell us that information that's wrapped up in a story just slides into the brain like a key into a lock. You know, you can get information into the brain other ways, but as hunter-gatherers, we didn't immediately rush for a twig and start sketching equations and graphs in the sand when we had some idea to convey. We told a story. Hmm. And if you can wrap an economic principle up in a story, it just stays with you a lot more easily. You don't have to really wrestle to get the idea. You'll go to talk about it with friends. You'll get better at it. It's just a much less painful and more effective way to learn about a subject.
Well, for example, talking about less pain, we're learning about a subject, the very important economic principle of supply and demand. You start that chapter off with a joke. Two economists see a $100 bill on the sidewalk. One stops to pick it up, and the other says, no, wait a minute. That can't be a $100 bill. If it were, somebody would have picked it up by now.
Yeah. If it's in an isolated location, maybe it's worth bending down to pick it up, but it's probably an ad for a massage parlor that looks like a $100 bill if it's out on a busy street corner. The joke really captures in a nice way the economic principle that there's no cash on the table, or at least not very much. So if an opportunity seems too good to be true, probably it is too good to be true. And what it really tells us is that once people have had a chance to react to events in the marketplace, the easy opportunities will have been used up. If there's a chance to make money at that point, it'll be only by some mix of talent and hard work and perseverance and luck. The easy money gets scooped up pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And these kinds of stories, these questions and answers, even these jokes, this is, in a way, a critique of the way economics is taught in this country.
Well, I think a lot of people think the book is just amusing stories. In fact, I intend it as a serious critique of the way we teach our subject to students. And I think the critique applies not just in economics, but in other disciplines as well, just from conversations I've had with people. What we know, Neil, is that when you give a student who's had the introductory course a test 6 months later to probe her knowledge of basic economic principles, she doesn't score any better on the average than somebody who didn't take the course at all. I mean, if you think about hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the course every semester, all the millions of hours students spend wrestling with the material we give them to ponder, and yet we can't measure any value added from that. That's scandalous.
So has any of your students posed the question, why do people take economics introductory courses?
Well, you know, if it were like language training for the diplomats or language training for Peace Corps volunteers, there'd be instant feedback. Hey, they're not learning what they need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens is that people take economics courses, and then most people out in the world don't know any economics either, and so there's never much feedback. Nobody tells them, hey, you didn't learn economics, because there aren't that many people out there who did learn economics. Mm. So I think it's a shame, really, because if you know some basic economic principles, first of all, it's interesting. You can understand a lot more of what you see out there in the world. But it also is a way to make much more intelligent choices. There's lots of interesting things we have to decide how to do and whether to do. If you know some basic economic principles, you can get good decisions a lot more easily.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on this conversation. Let's see if any of our callers has been able to come up with a question and an interesting answer that explains what some of the principles of economics. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Robert Frank is our guest. His book is The Economic Naturalist in Search of Answers to Everyday Enigmas. And let's see if we can start with George. And George is with us from Syracuse, New York.
Yeah, I'd like to know if you've ever noticed why hearing aid companies advertise on the radio.
Yeah, that has the earmarks of an interesting question. Yeah, I think all the ones that I selected for the volume had some twist like that. Neil mentioned the one about why keypad buttons on the drive-up ATM machines have braille dots on them. You know, just some. The listener hears the question, wants to know right away, why is that?
And George, why do you think that hearing aid companies advertise on the radio?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking. It always seemed like they say, an oxymoron.
Yeah. I'll take a stab at it. You know, the person who's hard of hearing is the last one to confront the fact that he doesn't hear so well. Usually it's business colleagues and relatives that have to bear the brunt of repeating themselves over and over again. So I think the radio ad really is aimed at the wife or the husband who needs to tell the spouse, hey, it's time to get fitted for a hearing aid, and I just heard about a revolutionary new design that can No one will see it, and it'll make you able to hear just like when you're 20.
Hmm.
That must be the one my wife insists that I need.
Probably is. But as we can tell, Georgia, you know how to listen to the radio. So
that's right. So if they were advertising, I'd hear it.
There you go. Appreciate the phone call.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Here's from Ben via email. Why does a phone number go from 1 to 9, top to left, bottom right, while computers go bottom left to top right?
That's a good one. Yeah, actually, a student did pose that question a few years ago, and Freakonomics.com blog ran an excerpt from The Economic Naturalist, and there were just hundreds of comments in response. One reader sent in about 25 or 26 questions. That was one of them there, too. The student who tackled that one, I've forgotten his name now, his explanation went roughly as follows. The calculator keypad came first. The phones weren't digital. They didn't have numeric keypads at all. They were rotary dial phones in the early days. And there had to be a correspondence between the numbers and the letters. And so it just seemed too odd in a rotary phone to have the A at the bottom and the Z at the top. You're going to have the small numbers, 1 and 2, at the very top of the dial, 0 at the bottom of the dial. It just seemed too discordant to have the low numbers and the high letters of the alphabet juxtaposed. And there wasn't really anything to mimic at that point since it wasn't a numeric keypad. It was only after there had been this association between numbers and letters from the rotary dial that they felt they needed to preserve that when they switched to the digital dial, the touch-tone dial.
And the letters were there on the rotary dial because people's numbers were Murray Hill this or
exactly.
Trafalgar 7.
Exactly, the prefixes.
Or, yeah, yeah.
Right.
And so, that's interesting. I appreciate that. We're talking today with Robert Frank. His book is The Economic Naturalist. If you'd like to take Professor Frank's challenge, come up with a question based on something you've observed. For example, the why do drive-up ATMs have Braille on the keys, and propose an answer, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back with more of your questions after a short break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The lesson today, economics is not boring. It's not just graphs and math. It's stories, too. Robert Frank argues economics is what happens around us all the time, in the car or the store or the movie theater. His new book uses economics to explain some of the world's everyday enigmas. Want to master the cost-benefit principle? It's a lot more fun than it sounds. And you can find the excerpt from Robert Frank's book that will make you an economic genius at npr.org/talk. Robert Frank is professor of economics at Cornell. His book is called The Economic Naturalist: In Search of Explanations for Everyday Enigmas. Again, we want you to take Professor Frank's challenge on the show today. Come up with a question based on something you've observed. Why are child safety seats required in cars but not on planes? And propose an answer. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org and check out the blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And again, we've repeated that a couple of times. The question, why do drive-up ATMs have Braille dots next to the numbers?
Yeah, that's one of my all-time favorites, Neil. It was posed by Bill Joe in 1997. He said that once the manufacturers of the machines make the machines with Braille dots on the keypads for the walk-up locations, they're going to want to do that anyway,
mm-hmm.
since blind people use those routinely. It's just cheaper and easier to make all the machines the same way rather than have two separate inventories, one with Braille dots, one without, and then worry about whether the right machines end up at the right destinations. The benefit of the machines is the same. Drivers don't seem to mind the fact that there are Braille dots on them. Most people don't even notice. So it's cheaper and the benefit's the same. So the cost-benefit principle, he argued, dictated doing it that way.
And interestingly, you then got a heated letter from one of your readers who said, wait a minute, there's another reason. It's required by law.
That's right. Ben Bernanke used that example in our introductory textbook, and I got an angry email from a professor saying, no, that's not why. They have them. And he sent me a link to the Americans with Disabilities Act webpage. And sure enough, there's a requirement that all keypads, even on drive-up machines, have Braille dots on them. Well, okay, I don't insist that the answers be right. What I tell my students is that they
this
be...
This is the kind of college class I like.
They have to be plausible hypotheses suitable for further testing. You know, it's not a PhD dissertation here. But I wrote back to my correspondent and I told him, well, consider the possibility. I thanked him for pointing out the link. But consider the possibility that the directors of the Americans with Disabilities Act at the end of the fiscal year said to themselves, hey, what can we do? The annual report's got to be turned in a week. Let's require Braille dots on the drive-up keypads. No one's going to object. They're going to do that anyway. And we can say we've served our constituents in this bold new way. So I urged my correspondent to think of that as a possible explanation for how the regulation got into the rule book to begin with.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Sanford. Sanford with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. What I had observed here in San Antonio anyway is that the longer you rent an apartment, the more they charge for you. Like every time you renew your lease, it goes up. But if you wanted to move in as a first-time move-in, they give you a huge discount.
Ah,
yeah,
very good question.
Like it's like they're trying to get you to move in, but they figure once you're there, they have you. You don't want to move again.
I think you've answered your own question there. What's interesting is how often we see variants of that pattern. So with your cell phone, if you'll switch plans, you'll get a terrific deal. If you'll switch cable companies, you'll get a terrific
credit
deal.
Credit cards, yeah.
All these credit card offers you get in the mail, they're for switchers, they're not for stayers. And it's just based on the simple fact that the people who are switching have choices in front of them that they're actively considering. Someone who's staying is more or less not got that on the front burner as something to think about. So they're just easier to put price increases onto if you're planning to stay anyway than if you're actively looking for a new alternative.
Hmm. Sanford, thanks very much. Good question.
Good question.
Right, great topic. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with, this is Jocelyn. Jocelyn's with us from Bend, Oregon.
Yes. My question is, why when you go to a inexpensive motel, you get free local calling, yet when you pay a lot for a motel room, they charge you?
That's a great one. In fact, there's an example in the book that's a variant of that. The question was why you get free internet access in a cheap hotel and you pay $15 a day or $10 a day for internet access in a luxury hotel. Why that? And then part B of the same question was why do luxury airlines feed you for free, budget airlines charge you for a meal? So, yeah, no, these are all interesting variants on a theme. If you're in a budget hotel, you're probably shopping around pretty carefully for where you're going to stay. The cost of letting you hook up to an internet network once it's established is essentially zero. They've got their costs all in place. There's no what economists call a marginal cost of adding another user. Just let someone tune in. The more competitive a market is, the closer the price of something will be to marginal cost. So that's why you see low internet access fees or zero internet access fees in budget hotels. The luxury hotel goer is either rich enough not to care or on expense account, and so the extra $10 or $15 a day on the bill isn't going to be a deal breaker. He wants to stay at that hotel because it's in that location or because it offers that special mix of services. It's not a question of how much is the internet access.
Hmm. Jocelyn, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good question.
Here's an email from Ryan in Cincinnati. Why do the road signs you see when entering highways state things that are prohibited, like bicycles, pedestrian, etc., and then at the bottom it states, and animals on foot? What else would they be doing, driving a Honda? I think this may be a more grammatical or a punctuation. Each shoots leaves, I think, is the book he wants with this.
Exactly. Yeah, I can't help you with that one.
This is an email from Sean in Toronto, Ontario. Why do books have U.S. and Canadian prices printed on them when these prices are often not used and the relative values of the currencies change? And he answers his own question. I assume this is because they're printed in both countries and the cost of publishing is not the same.
Yeah, the North American rights for a book, that's one of the most important markets for any book. And typically North American rights come as a package, including both Canadian and U.S. rights. And typically books do print the list price on the dust jacket. And typically the Canadian currency doesn't trade one for one against the dollar. That's news to me that the actual currency conversion isn't roughly as printed on the dust jacket. It may be that...
Well, it may have been when it was printed, but it does tend to change.
It may be the exchange rates have slid a little bit, or maybe the purchaser is going to a discount bookstore in one country and a list price bookstore in another. Yeah, there could be other possibilities causing the pattern. I don't know.
Let's go to Jeff. Jeff's with us from Sierra Vista in Arizona.
Hey, I'm... from Southern Arizona here, and I'm wondering, I'm at a gas station, I'm looking at the price, it says 283 and 9 tenths, and I've always asked, can I get the 0.1% back, you know, kind of thing. You know, I think obviously it's, you know, they have to charge one penny over, but we think we're actually getting a deal when we're not.
Yeah, it's the whole 99 cents, is this a psychological ploy on the pricer's behalf, do you think, Robert Frank?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book called Psychology Meets Economics, and the examples in that chapter confront the fact that economic principles don't get you all the way there with a lot of these questions. And the fact is we're human beings. We have brains that are imperfect. They take shortcuts. When you see $5.99 on a price tag, somehow that seems cheaper than $6.01, even though it's essentially the same price. And I think gas stations... noticed that early on, and that became a tradition in their metering machines. They always had the 9 tenths. And I think it does sound cheaper to people, even though they know logically, you know, there are lots of things like that. You know, I set my watch 10 minutes ahead. I get there on time more reliably when I do that, even though I know exactly what time it is when somebody asks me. You know, the brain just, it's a funny organ. You know, we can't really explain what people do unless we're willing to take some insights from psychology and sociology and other disciplines and mix them in with what we do.
And that's sort of a shocking admission there. Economics doesn't have every answer.
No, in fact, Neil, one of the growth segments in economics in the last couple of decades has been a field called behavioral economics. This is work at the intersection of economics, psychology, and increasingly biology, trying to draw on insights from those disciplines, sociology too, in coming up with a more complete description of what people seem to be up to.
Thanks very much for the call, Jeff.
Hey, no problem.
I was fascinated by your chapter on discount and the concept. I had not run across it. I never took Econ 101, certainly not in your class. The discount hurdle, and by way of illustration, why don't you answer the question of why are hotel minibars so pricey?
Yeah, most people have noticed that when you go to buy a bottle of water in a mini bar, it can be $6, $8, $10. You go across the street to the drugstore, the same bottle's on sale for a buck. What's going on here? The hotel knows that some people care more about price than others. That's true for the purchase of any item. The manufacturer, the seller, the hotelier in this case, wants to charge the highest price possible but can't charge everybody the highest price, or else they have unfilled rooms most nights. So they want to give discounts to some people, but not to others. So how do they know who needs a discount, who won't come unless you get a discount? One trick they use is to put a hurdle in your pathway. If you jump the hurdle, then you get a discount. So they make the price of the room, the basic room, lower than it would otherwise have to be, and then they try to get the people who don't care much about price to fill in and pay more by charging extra for the frills. We mentioned earlier the internet access, the mini bars. So, you know, if you have a price insensitive customer and he wants a glass of wine, he's not going to go out on the street looking for a liquor store when there's a little half bottle of wine right there in the mini bar. He'll pay the exorbitant price and enjoy the convenience of it. So it's that person who's paying the high price by not being willing to jump over the hurdle of going out onto the street and looking for the cheaper version. There's no product you can find almost that doesn't present you with some version of that choice. If you jump the hurdle, you get a discount. The mail-in rebate coupon is an example. There are just hundreds of examples, ingenious little tricks sellers have come up with to target the discounts to the people who really do care about price.
Robert Frank chronicles many of those tricks in his new book, The Economic Naturalist in Search of Answers to Everyday Enigmas. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also go and read what other listeners have to say on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Al. Al's with us from Long Island on New York.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, go ahead, Al.
Yeah, hi. This is a purely untested hypothesis in my observation. I've been an avid flea market, experienced flea market buyer where a lot of antiques and some valuable merchandise is sold. It seems that in good economic times, the prices are high. In bad economic times, the prices remain high, or even go higher. And I was trying to figure out what the answer to this is. And I thought that perhaps the dealers who hold the, you know, who buy the antiques and have them as investments, have money in the, invested in the antiques, don't want to lose the value of their merchandise. So they hold on to their merchandise and even increase the prices to shake out some of the middling buyers and try to target the population with the segment of population with deeper pockets, or they also want to prove that their merchandise or antiques are very valuable. That's my observation.
How does that stand up, do you think?
So prices are always high, whether demand's high or not, in this market. And that's a pattern that we see across a lot of markets, actually. Prices tend to be sticky on the way down. They're quite willing to raise prices when there are more people wanting to buy something than there are units available for sale. But when demand runs slack, you see it especially in the housing market. So somebody paid $100,000 for a house, then the housing bubble is pricked and you can't move that house. It sits on the market sometimes 2-3 years. The buyer knows he paid $300,000 for it. He just can't bring himself to sell it for $220,000, yeah, which is maybe what he could get. So he says, perhaps rationally, I'm going to sit on it and hope for better times in the future. Mm. I'm not going to take that loss. It's a phenomenon called loss aversion. We're very reluctant to take a loss.
Okay.
And people who've bought antiques at a high price, now demand softens, they're going to hold on to them at least longer than economic theory might predict because they're so reluctant to take that loss.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good shopping, Al.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. While we're talking about prices, these things are relatively easy to quantify. Toward the end of your book, you go into the informal market for personal relationships, and I was fascinated by some of the questions and answers here. For example, why is it easier to find a partner when you already have one?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's interesting, my TAs, both of whom were women that semester, didn't like the question, and I thought it was really interesting. So it may be one that falls on different ears differently. But the question was posed by a student, a male student. He had a very attractive female friend with whom he'd enjoyed a platonic relationship for some extended period of time. She knew he'd been having trouble meeting people, and so as he recounts his experience, one day she said, come on with me to a bar tonight. I'm going to help you meet someone. So they went to the bar, and they're sitting at their table, and she's just paying extremely close attention to him the whole evening, touching his arm, rubbing his shoulder, whispering in his ear frequently. And then she says to him abruptly, I'm going to head home now, but meet me at Starbucks in the morning for coffee, and let's see how the rest of your evening went. And he reports that the moment she left, other women in the bar came around and started chatting him up, which was an experience he hadn't had before. What's going on here? He's wondering. And so when he recounted the experience to his friend at Starbucks the next morning, she wasn't surprised at all. She said, I knew exactly that would happen once I left. And her explanation was this. She knew herself to be a really attractive young woman. She knew that attractive women are in very short supply. Men want them. There aren't that many of them. And so whenever one is available, then everybody flocks to her. If such a woman chose to lavish her attention on this guy, that's a signal that he must have been pretty good because she wouldn't have to settle for any old schlemiel. And so you can't tell just by looking at somebody, he argued, whether they're interesting or going to be a good person to go out with. But that was a signal that conveyed a lot of information. The fact that this gorgeous woman seemed very interested in him told other people that, well, he must have something going for him.
The Economic Naturalist in Search of Answers to Everyday Enigmas by Robert H. Frank. Professor Frank, thanks so much for being with us and for conducting your class on the radio today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Coming up, so much for mowing lawns and babysitting. Today, kids work at unpaid internships. Are they missing out on important life lessons? We'll talk about that next. 800-989-8255. Plus, we remember the scooter. Phil Rizzuto died earlier today. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News.